Okay, Edwin, go for it.
Yes.
Good morning, everyone.
There are so many young, lovely people here. I looked up the dictionary, what does it mean, youth? And I find it very interesting. It means the son, the young bull. Then it means hero. Imagine all the heroes here. Yeah? It means immature, the opposite perhaps. Last, initiative, boldness, and subversion. Dangerous to the younger generation. And under the old man, including myself, father, master, tradition, contemplation. You have the word temple in the word contemplation. And then it means justice. Interesting?
Thank you. Okay, this is... Any questions? I had a hand here and you wanted to say something? Of course, you didn't address, no? Would you like to... You had a question for Carol?
Well, I already addressed, but it was about the windmill effects on the... the environment in terms of noise pollution and bird migration.
So that's what I bird migration, I don't know anything about. As far as that question, I don't know. Tamil Nadu has, at this present moment, 41 sites, and more sites are being developed. So there will be more. I don't know what kind of bird migration exists in the south of India. Where they come from, probably from the north, probably from Siberia, I have no idea. I don't know what it does, so I can't answer that question. The other question was about noise. The wind farm I have seen was pretty far away from big cities, and the farmers who used to own those land were marginal subsistence farmers who were extremely happy when the industry started developing wind farms there, because suddenly their land prices raised tremendously and they could send their kids to schools which otherwise would not have been possible. The net result is that many of these kids will never come back there, and that the parents are slowly moving out with the kids. So most of these wind parks, I cannot speak with authority about all of them, but most of them have been set up in pretty big wastelands and has been a benefit for the local population.
The land was owned previously by the local farmers, then their land value increased, and then they've now sold and moved, or some are also leasing?
No, most of that, most wind farms are all owned by the companies, because the legal structure is that the wind mill follows the land, so you have to own the land, so they will never take any risk with that.
So the first question with the birds, I can answer because we have a lot of experience in Germany. Birds go, they know it after a short time. It's like they don't fly to church towers or something. It's a really short time and then they know they don't fly there. There are studies in Germany about this because same concerns that we have 10,000 of birds. So it's taken a very short time and then they don't fly there anymore. They go higher or around.
Also, just on this wasteland, just a quick note. I know that in the 90s I was visiting the Kanyakumari district where there were wind farms, but what had happened there was because of the Green Revolution, the very fertile lands had been rendered waste, and after that the farmers were forced to migrate, and then the only other option was to set up wind farms. I did see that. Question from the back from Tara?
Just a comment on that. They may learn quickly, but many die in the process of learning.
Birds?
Yes. And I was just wondering if there was any discussion about integrating the local villages into the windmill power grid.
In Orville and surrounding, you mean?
Oh.
Yes, definitely. But we have just managed to set up our first windmill. So that first windmill is going to supply about 25% of Orville's current electricity requirement. The second windmill needs to be back with half of the proceeds of the first windmill and the full proceeds of the second windmill because we need to get a loan. These windmills cost about $1 million apiece, so it takes a bit of investment and that money is not always available. If we are lucky, in about 5 to 6 years, we have 4 windmills up and running, and in about 8 years, we would have these windmills free of energy. By that time, it is a good time to start thinking in wider context, to what extent villages could profit from this kind of donation, but not immediately.
Carol, I had a question on that. One of your slides said that the consumer needs to own 26% of the generator. So is Varuna accepted as a consumer?
Is Varuna there a... is a producer. The consumer would be the Orville Foundation. And the Orville Foundation is a very unique animal in legal India, to the sense it doesn't fit actually anywhere. It has been created by a very special act of the Indian Parliament, which is unique by itself, that the government of India would even bother to inform itself and to get busy with an entity like this, but they do, and very much so. And they created a special act of Parliament called the Orville Foundation Act. Now that Orville Foundation Act, again, because this is a special animal, suddenly gets very special concessions. One of the concessions is that we don't pay income tax. That means the foundation. We are not talking about individuals in Orville. The foundation doesn't pay income tax over its income. One of the conditions is that the foundation cannot participate, cannot put its money into any commercial undertaking. So it cannot hold shares in a private limited. So there we were virtually blocked because we had initially understood that this would be a possibility. Our lawyers had told us, yes, you can do it. But then we went to our tax advisors. They said, no, go. You can't do that. You lose your exemption. So we said, fine. Now, it doesn't matter much because at this present moment, what Orville receives is a donation
right.
in the order of 30 lakhs on which it doesn't pay tax. So, okay, instead of that, we wheel energy into Orville. We just give a donation and they pay the electricity bill.
Right. So my understanding is until the legalities are worked out, you can't wheel energy.
Also because we don't own the high tension lines at present.
Right.
We would also have to create that. And that's far away. Meanwhile, we give donations and the donations are offsetting Orville's energy bill. That's it.
Perhaps to add this on the physical side, we never will consume the wind energy which is produced. We consume the energy which is produced in the nearest power plant to our world. It may be a nuclear or a hydro or a lignite.
It's basically a credit.
It's just it's produced,
a green credit.
By the local people because of the physics.
Yeah.
Well, one interesting thing is when you show that film of the global grid, Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, Kerala have now agreed that they are going to share energy free of charge. And that's very interesting because Tamil Nadu produces an overdose of energy in these high wind season months, and they are ready now to transport that when the other parties meet, and similar for the vessel. So there is a kind of integration coming up.
I'm interested in the disparity between the amount of time, energy, and money that's invested in developing new sources of renewable energy, and the amount of time and energy that there's essentially changing the mindset and lowering the demand for energy consumption. And I was really interested to hear about the Bangalore project. Are there any activities in that locally? And anything
change the mindset?
Or what other work is in progress on
you see, I think different groups are really engaged in various investigations in this. As far as energy is concerned, the major investigations that have been done or encouragements that have been done have come from Aurora. Also, there have been windmills in Aurora pumping water because we have low velocity, so we're using windmills here in the greenbelt area mainly to pump the water. So there is energy conservation in process. Then those of you who have witnessed what Satprem has presented here is again a new material technology where there is solar energy in use and manual energy is in use and there is no other energy being used as such. And in fact, to supplement this, I have been investigating a little bit of energy inputs. If we are going to excavate a lake, for instance, there's going to be a huge mass of the earth that is going to come out because it is 16 hectares in surface area and not less than minimum 5 meters in depth. So you're talking of a huge mass of earth. How are we going to use it? And if we can make it into a profitable venture, we can convert it to bricks and follow the technology that Satprem has developed, 6 to 7% cement, the rest is your earth, and you have a wonderful product. And I have just been to Delhi, where I have seen the trials done on our soil on a machine. And I think it is another area I didn't do it. Also, there are now a very clear consciousness as far as the building materials are concerned, or the building norms as you call them, that we should now concentrate more and more on the areas of what we call green technologies. But the most important aspect from my point of view is to look at also the water in the holistic manner, where an emphasis has to be laid very heavily on what is naturally available water to us from the rain, harvested in the form of the rooftop harvesting, in the form of the stormwater harvesting, in the form of also wastewater conversion. And we are at the moment prototyping all three of those. And in fact, you can see the examples of it, and there have been studies made on it, and it does provide a possibility that we could be absolutely water sustainable in due course of time if we use this holistic method, followed up in case of any deficient years of rain with desalinated water coming into play. I think Auroville has all these elements which are being practiced, prototypes have been done. The only thing I find is we have not been able to put it all together in a single project like somebody in Bangalore has managed to do it. Please.
I wanted to ask you about the relationship between bamboo growing and water consumption, because in creating a sustainable system, obviously there are two ends to the bamboo energy source production that may be a concern. Technologically, I don't know. I'm just asking the question. On one end, you've got this water consumption, and on the other end, you're using heat energy to produce electricity. And one of the things that has more or less unconsciously happened here is that we've created carbon sequestration on a very large scale. Is there going to be a balance between this new amount of carbon dioxide creation and the carbon sequestration that's already taking place in the environment? As somebody already suggested, on a global scale, these trade-offs often don't reduce the amount of carbon that's actually
somewhere else,
being created. They just redistribute. But at the same time, there's an increase going on. So I see an increase in carbon dioxide production and an increase in water use implied by what you're suggesting.
You have raised three questions as far as I know in this statement. As far as water consumption for bamboo growing is concerned, the studies that I have had so far from various sources, it doesn't consume even as much water as a cane does, for instance. Okay, and it is now accepted
sugarcane.
Yeah,
but sugarcane
is very highly intensive.
Is high.
What is accepted now is that while sugarcane receives per plant about 20 liters, compared to that, this bamboo takes 8 liters. Okay. Well, these are 8 liters per plant per day, not acres.
Which
okay.
is a lot of water.
Yes, okay.
Are we talking of a single bamboo plant or the cluster?
You see, from a single plant grows a cluster of 12. So it is a consumption of that 12. Now, this is an area that is under study, okay? But it is now being considered as an agricultural product rather than a forest product, okay? Because the yield that it gives, and also if you are participating in water harvesting in many ways, you can find your balance. As far as the carbon is concerned, I think that overall Auroville has to find a way of not only balancing its carbon generation and also its reduction, but even become positive. And bamboo is one of those plants which gives you the positive benefit, because what has been calculated, and I'm not an expert on that, I'm only sharing with you what I've been told, that a human being generates about 0.85 tons of carbon dioxide a year. Whilst a single bamboo plant, which becomes a cluster eventually, consumes 1.3 tons of carbon dioxide. Okay. So that gives you a surplus there as well. And in fact, some of the efforts are being made to make Chennai absolutely carbon free by planting more and more bamboos wherever they can. But as I said, this is an area, on one side you have the positives, there are also areas to be looked into which can create a negative situation. Then coming to the commercial aspect of buying and selling of carbon credits, I realize that there are different points of view on this, from ethical point of view, from various other points of view. But even if that was not there, as far as I am concerned, it is worthwhile doing a sustainable generation of power, localized, decentralized if possible. Now, as far as the heat generators is concerned, today technologies are available that you could improve your thermal efficiency by converting that heat energy into various other activities. One of them is chilling water or cold storage, which again completes your cycle as far as closing the loop is concerned, and you get all the benefits. So there are a number of possibilities, so there's not isolated issues.
Question in the back, and then B. Yeah, you first.
Do you see a possibility that we can join this zero energy movement in Oroville, and what would you see would be the means we have to use to come to this zero energy idea?
About joining other energy sources, I do not know, because my concern basically is, can Oroville develop itself as a sustainable base in terms of energy or various other aspects that we talk about? And if at the right moment there are synergies available, why should we refuse to join? We will definitely join it because it is mutually beneficial. I'll give you another example. Now I'm talking of bamboo again, except for this water issue that you have raised. You see, today the villages around us, this was earlier a question also asked from Carol, are basically not doing any serious agriculture within the area, what we call a green belt. Most of them are dependent on cashew or casuarina and things like that. But if they can form themselves into cooperatives, and I know one that has happened in Haryana, if you like I can share that with you, but idea is, if they can form themselves into, instead of selling these lands of theirs to the manipulators and developers from outside, they can develop a sustainable income for their families for generations to come. This would be another idea where I think we'll be sharing it with our neighbors at the appropriate time, and develop it in such a fashion that our green belt cover is maintained, green belt activities are maintained. At the same time, the villagers who today are very anxious to sell because the prices are high, do not sell anymore. So there are a number of possibilities that can emerge from this. So you have to then eventually see the overall, where are your balances, negative or positive? And I believe that we will be working more and more towards the positive balances.
I was just wondering how you foresee in the Oroville context closing those cycles, because it seems like you need energy planning at at a complete city level to get all the inputs going together, because the methane generation that you speak of could be combined with the waste treatment, and we have a biomass that is, as you mentioned, growing like mad, which is the garbage. And Pondi is giving us 650 tons a day on our doorstep. So we have these things, and how to combine that. And one of my thoughts was that the biogas digester is probably the ideal thing, because you can input there all, even paper waste and the compost and the toilet and the kitchens, and everything can go into a biogas digester, especially because they have the enzymes now that will break down wood and everything. And then there you get the methane to do the work. Then you get another product, which is compost coming out. So how to fit that all together with, you know, with the planning of Oroville?
As far as I'm concerned, Oroville has to work both ways. Decentralized and gradually opening up to the centralized, because if the city has to develop, because what we are today, we are neither a city nor a village. We are spread out communities at different points out of necessity. But eventually, the city has to be developed. That is our goal. So whilst that is happening, these decentralized activities, localized activities, should be the ones which should be emphasized on and give. Now the question is, where are the resources? You see, where we get stuck in Oroville is lack of resources. Ideas are plenty. And I personally believe that is where we have to put our heads together centrally to develop resources in such a way that these activities at a decentralized level can be developed. From a planning point of view, what we consider is that decentralized activities should be developed in such a way that eventually in all these areas, whether it's wastewater, whether it's energy, whether it is compost or whatever, we create grids, different grids, which can be linked up to a central activity in due course of time when the movement arises for the centralized activity. It is that approach, according to me, which will fulfill the requirements of our world's growth and development. On the other hand, there is a very slow growth for the simple reason, as I mentioned, lack of resources. But at the moment, if we look around us, we have tremendous assets which can be the focal point of creating more and more assets for us. And that is another subject which anytime one wants to discuss, I'll be very happy to discuss. We have assets which we have not managed well till now. That's my final statement. Please.
Yes, an indirect question. But why do these farmers still get this free energy to pump water? I mean, how come this is not stopped? It must be a political issue.
It's very political. Very political.
It's a vote bank, that's all.
It's a vote bank.
It makes you mightily popular to ask them to start paying for the electricity, so any party which proposes that will automatically lose power in the next elections. So the party who then, for the sake of argument, will say, no, that's a very bad decision. If Tamil Nadu, the political parties, could come together and support it jointly, it would be for the benefit of the state. At this present moment, it's simply political advantage to create your vote bank. Nothing else.
And the sad thing around that is they actually started a few years back to tax government institutions. So individual farmers get free electricity, but if you're considered to be a government institution, which Oroville unfortunately is, then is legally regarded as a government institution, then we pay for electricity.
We pay even for agriculture.
Not so anymore, sorry. This is no? Old news, no. We have
We successfully fought it.
And we finally got the tariff reduced. It means that anything for agriculture Oroville also doesn't pay for.
Okay.
We do, however, are more conscious about our water needs. The main problem was, of course, that farmers started planting that which gave them the most money, which happened to be sugarcane or coconuts. And if you go alongside the coast at present, and you take the trouble to stand a little bit looking at one of those coconut plantations, you see that they flooded.
Yeah.
And the coast is the most dangerous area, because if you flood it too much, you throw too much water out of the underground and you get saline intrusion. Mm-hmm. And there are huge parts at the coast in Tamil Nadu where that saline intrusion has happened. And experts say that once it has happened, it's almost irreversible. Which means that the entire coast turns saline, and that these people then can start relying on drinking water which is brought by carriers, and then they wash themselves with half brackish, half saline water, which is very unpleasant. And the awareness is too limited.
Unhealthy as well.
Very unhealthy.
So maybe not on the subject, but have we come up with crisis scenarios? What would happen if the water is starting to salinize and people go nuts?
one of the projects for that is a desalination plant on the beach, to desalinate the water. And of course, if you start tomorrow a desalination plant on the beach, don't think that you can start supplying water to Oroville ignoring the population which has the problem. They will break down the fence if necessary in order to get the water. So any such attempts are going to be having a very wide impact on the surroundings. You cannot do anything like that without the full cooperation of the local village. If we get the line, the entire area gets the line. And the entire area gets the line actually before us, because we are somewhere still pretty high up. And one of the things Oroville is doing, and I think that is hardly recognized, is this enormous work in the canyons. There's huge water harvesting going on in the canyons. I don't know if it is part of your plan to show them Biscuit, the utility canyon is one. There are four canyons, major canyons, which run off towards the sea. And all these four canyons have been dammed, and each dam has created a catchment area. And it's not one dam in each, but a whole series of dams, so that this gradually flow up. And net result is that the water level, the aquifer level, in the coastal villages has actually stabilized and even increased somewhat over the last years. That's only because of the percolations these dams provide. Because it has stabilized, we don't have saline intrusion as yet. We don't know if this is going to happen in the future, but at present, we can only say that the dams have helped to prevent saline water intrusion. And that's fantastic. And that was something we didn't know in the beginning.
Just I want to add to this. There is also a geological fault which is fortunate for us at the moment, because desalination is not happening directly, although our water tables have gone down considerably. But what is happening around us is that it is infiltration indirectly that is coming into as saline water. And I personally believe that the more and more we infiltrate, more and more we harvest, the more and more we will be able to successfully fight against the salination of the water in our areas.
Can I just add to that? I think this is a very touchy subject as far as Oroville and the bioregion is concerned. This is a problem which affects the whole region.
Yeah.
So you can't address it just by harvesting in Oroville. So from where I I see this as something which has to be addressed, and Oroville has to play a major role in that, and maybe we are lacking right now, is to affect policy and go out there more aggressively to create awareness among the farmers and also the citizens of Pondicherry and other major cities in the coastal area, if we really want this to reverse or stall. Otherwise, and even if we find solutions for say Oroville or the smaller bioregion, just like energy, oil, water will become a very precious commodity, and we want to be open to the rest of the world. And if we are not fenced off, you can imagine what will happen. If there is brackish water, saline water across the coast, and Oroville has its solution in coming years. So I think we'll have to go out there more aggressively, create more awareness, make farmers more aware of what pumping out water means from the ground, introduce solutions like maybe drip irrigation systems and others to reduce the water consumption. That's the only way.
Yeah. I think that's a really important perspective, because just because you might find a solution to supply the amount of energy that we need, which is relatively sustainable, as long as lignite is the main source of energy for our bioregion, we are not really impacting the question of sustainability very much. And so if bamboo harvesting, for example, is going to be an energy source, then it's important to ask the question, how viable is that on a regional scale, and not just on a local municipal scale?
And this, I want to add this, that but when I talk about harvesting, I'm not talking of only of Oroville. I'm talking of harvesting as a principle. And harvesting needs to be done. And another aspect which Oroville has contributed a great deal in this direction is renovating and rehabilitating the old system of tanks with Tamil Nadu. So there is a regional effort going on. Yes, perhaps what is lacking is an educational aspect of it, and this is where he and his colleagues come into play under this concentrated village development that you are working through the Knowledge Commission. I mean, there's a plenty of work to be done in that direction.
Huge amount of work.
Yeah.
We actually have a seminar on water management in 2 weeks, so all of you are welcome to come back and continue the discussion. I'd like to hear more questions about energy. I saw Grayson and B. It wasn't about energy. Is it a water question that you want to?
No, it was a monoculture. Like a monoculture.
Could you speak up a bit?
Yeah. It seems like these bamboo fields are just monocultures, you know. It's just like, like lack of diversity. Have you thought about like diversifying these bamboo fields? Maybe planting like vegetables or.
So the question is, Aurovillian foresters especially have prided themselves in bringing back the original biodiversity with the tropical drive of green forest. So if we're looking at cultivating just bamboo in a green belt, or mainly bamboo, where is the diversity coming from? It's a monoculture.
I am not personally looking at this aspect in that fashion, because there are various varieties of bamboo which are used for different purposes. So it is not strictly a monoculture if you look at it from that point of view. And secondly, it is now being considered as an agricultural product rather than a forest product, because the natural bamboo was a forest product. Okay? And therefore, you can even mix the different varieties of bamboo, one. Second is that you could also grow bamboo. Say you put 100 plants in one place and you have the rest of the thing. You look at the 5 parks that are intended for Auroville. This could be part and parcel of your landscaping. I mean, it need not necessarily grow en masse in an acreage. And you can harvest it all the time, because part of the bamboo will always be available, so all you are harvesting is 1/4 of it. So from that point of view, you have a plenty of areas, and then you have lands outside the green belt, which if you look at it, let me give you an example of Annapurna Farm, for instance. 120 acres at the moment is not under agriculture. From time to time, according to the resources, whatever they can manage to grow, they grow. But if they are supported, 120 acres of bamboo. You take Hermitage, you take many other places which at the moment are merely being kept because there is no activity there as such. Now these are the areas which can become very actively productive and beneficial to Auroville. They can contribute instead of drawing on the resources of limited resources of Auroville in terms of subsidies.
Can I just add
that?
So I think your point on monoculture, I think you're talking from all the studies that have been done on monoculture and the impact of that. And so the danger is with any kind of bio product, like it happened with soya in many areas where it became like a cash crop, and it had a huge impact on the local economies, and the land after some time becomes less fertile. And also it affects the biodiversity and as other issues. We will have to be very careful when we come up with any kind of solution which is to do with relying on agricultural produce, like Pashi was saying. So because I think one of the solutions could be, and I don't know, I haven't spoken to Pashi about this, is because we have such a large landmass that we look after, if we scatter these bamboo trees across the whole bioregion, where we know how to harvest them somehow. We create mechanisms to harvest them within the whole wooded area. Perhaps that might create the biodiversity that we need and a balance and also sustainable harvesting.
Thanks for putting it in the right words. This is exactly what I was trying to say.
I just one comment on bamboo. If anybody walks in the forest, there are already these big clumps of bamboo in most of the forest, so it is a viable option. What I wanted to get back to was the solar energy and the use of solar cookers, which in the early days in Oroville, CSR pioneered a lot of solar cookers and things, but that whole solar cooker thing seems to have died out.
Yeah.
And the Aurovisions don't use solar cookers anymore. I guess because they thought the big mirror now is in the solar kitchen that takes care of everybody. But why haven't these new types of solar cookers like Aurora, don't they promote that?
That's a subject very close to my heart. And I don't know the answer, but I will just talk about this for a couple of minutes. The government of India has been pushing solar cookers with subsidies, almost free distribution, for 40 years now, with no success. And I have not done any market research on this, but my belief right now is it's because of two main reasons. One is convenience, and second is fashion. So the solar cooking is not convenient for me, and I have other viable, convenient means to make my food, why would I cook on solar cookers? And we talk to a lot of villagers on this subject, actually, where they have to go out there to collect biomass to fuel their cookers. And even there, it's very difficult. And second is fashion. I mean, the solar cookers that we have, they look ugly. They're not like Macs, you know, they're like PCs of 80s with big boxes and all of that. So unless we make it more interesting for people to cook on solar cookers, it's not going to fly. So one of the initiatives that we are working on is to work with the Village Action Group. Anyone knows Village Action Group?
Yeah.
To go to the communities, and there we have one person who has been actively using, a middle class person, solar cookers in Pondicherry. Because of Professor Chaman Lalji, who is a pioneer of solar energy in India, he's based in Pondicherry. A lot of his students took solar cooking to heart 20 years ago, and they're still cooking on solar cookers. So they are the real examples where, you know, they managed to be able to live on solar cooking, make all the different recipes, make you know, food that the children will like, and so on. So we brought one of the housewives from that family to come and talk to the villagers, where we have an example, a live example of someone who is using solar cookers successfully rather than someone who is just preaching. And we are also working with a couple of volunteers right now to see how we can make solar cookers look like Macs, you know, or iPods of this world. They have to look interesting, they have to look appealing. That's the only way to get people to use more. And plus come up with more and more recipes on solar cooking, because solar cookers can't make everything. They can't make bread, for example, chapatis. They can't fry stuff. A lot of the diet that we have in India is fried.
Right.
So we will have to come up with hybrid solutions which are easy to implement for different user group segments, including Aurovillians, where it becomes more acceptable. In fact, we will have to start orienting our houses in such a way that the kitchens face the south, you know, the south, and where, you know, you just they have designed a building in Delhi, I've been told, apartment block, where the kitchens face are south facing. So, you know, the window opens and the solar cooker comes out and it cooks a little bit of food and it goes in again. So we need innovations like that for people to accept it. If it's not convenient, no one will buy it.
Also, I was wondering, you know, I mean, also to cook on solar, it would mean that instead of I'm mostly out of the house from 9 to 5, it would mean I actually have to be in the house cooking my
You don't actually, that's the misconception.
That you put it in and you go out and it's
It never burns.
It never burns.
Solar cooked food never burns, and in fact they say the nutrients are more alive in solar cooking because it's slow cooking, you know,
right,
which is very fashionable these days.
Yeah,
I have a question about new technologies of solar for electricity production. There are these solar foils which are very easy to put on roofs and everywhere, but you cannot get them in India, and you cannot get them if you want to build a new place here. And to import them from Europe or from the United States is quite complicated. So do you any see a possibility of new solar technologies to be in Oroville also present? Right now.
The solar PV arena is going through a lot of change, a lot of innovation in terms of how it's manufactured, how it looks like. It's getting thinner and thinner. They're using more and more materials which are more efficient. So right now the highest efficiency you get with PV is around 16% to 17%. They are testing some materials which are 22% efficiency. But these things are still in experimental stage, and they are expensive to try out. But wherever possible, we do try new products, new materials. The biggest challenge we have with solar energy is not the capturing the energy, it's the storage. And storage is a problem across the board. And there, I think not much is happening in terms of new solutions right away. There's a lot of good pipeline of ideas on how to store energy. But that's where I think we get stuck with solar energy.
Feed it back to the grid?
We don't have that, I'm afraid, in India. It's changing, though. There are policies which will allow people to feed back into the grid. But right now, only power generators are allowed to feed back, not domestic users.
Also, I mean, the huge things, as this German woman, Laura, was saying, or Lynn was saying, policies could change drastically the way we look at things, our consumption patterns, taking the subsidy from electricity, Tamil Nadu farmers. If I'm not mistaken, in Germany, they additionally impose a carbon tax. So anyone using anything based on fossil fuels now pays an additional tax. And such a policy, for instance, would get me off from my addiction to cooking gas to move to solar.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Why don't you hear from him? Sorry. And you're next.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The problem also with solar cookers, it's you really have to change the habits of cooking, because it takes about much more time. Like if you need 20 minutes, you will need 40 minutes. It's about this.
I think
and also you cannot open your system. You know, I saw the Amas making food. It's you put something in it and then you put other things and you cook, and in 20 minutes it's finished. You cover it and it's finished. So you really have to change how you're cooking. And
absolutely.
I think that is one of the hardest parts.
Changing habits
of
people
cooking
is very difficult. But the thing is, if it's fashionable, we do it.
Sure.
Like cycling became fashionable in Europe,
sure,
and it caught on. And the same thing happens with anything that we do. If, for example, let's talk about middle class segment in India. If solar cooking becomes fashionable, and next time I have a party, I invite people and say, hey guys, this is solar cooked. It tastes nice. Suddenly you will see that people are adopting it more. And that's the thing we have to get to, where, people who are celebrities or, whatever, are in the media, kind of try and propagate this and make it fashionable. Fashion, we do weird things for fashion. We pierce our tongues and all sorts. So I think it's a very important aspect to look at.
Pashi and then Rod.
My question was of a general nature, that the government of India is now talking in terms of a massive solar power generation in Rajasthan desert.
I know.
What are your comments on it?
It's been being planned for the last 15 years, but I think it's a great idea, because it's a desert area, it's uninhabitable. There is not much wildlife there, so from that point of view, it's a good idea. The government of India or any other government has been investing huge amounts of money in conventional power plants, so the cost of energy that you get at your house, highly subsidized. So now when they start to subsidize, renewable energy power stations, I think that will give an impetus to the industry, and which will bring the price down, hopefully, and more adoption of technology.
Raj?
I'm getting the impression that this question of sustainability is something that you take very, very casually. One of the things that you gather from reading Plan B, and Lester Brown has studied the subject more comprehensively than anybody else probably, is a sense of the necessity not to take these issues casually. In fact, if they are not, if the various approaches including policy change and appeal and efficiency and integrality of systems and so on are not adopted fairly soon, then as Lovelock says, there's not going to be much point in even trying to create alternatives, because there's a tipping point in the environmental situation of the human habitat. So it's nice that we are thinking about these things and exploring a few possibilities. But the problem was just touched upon, that is the government's policies. There's a possibility for India to adopt sustainable energy as a policy, because the population as a whole is still able to accept so-called appropriate technologies more easily than an urban development in the West is able to accept it. And so the government of India could make choices that would significantly impact
absolutely
the problems that lead us to consider these options. But as long as we're just considering these options and not addressing those problems, then we're not doing what Lester Brown says we're going to have to do. And the two studies that I know of that are most serious, his and Limits to Growth, have both been saying for 30 years that if these solutions aren't adopted comprehensively by 2020, then we already passed the tipping point.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is what chance do we have of creating a model that is significant enough to impact policy?
Absolutely.
And how long are we going to take to do it? You know, because
that's a very interesting point there. If Auroville considers to be a place where we are looking for future solutions for mankind, I think we should set examples which the government can adopt as policy. Now, having said that, you talked about why doesn't the government of India adopt, you know, alternative energy solutions as their mainstream policy. It all boils down to money, by the way. And
I didn't actually ask that question because I just pointed out that they don't.
Yes, yes. But it boils down to money. And what's interesting is we are all human beings after all. We have the same aspirations. We want comfort, convenience. And that's how the nature works also. Nature is looking for convenience, convenient lifestyles. And what happens is when the media says to me that this is what a normal lifestyle is in the West. I just came back. I used to live in London, and I just came back from there. A friend of mine, who is a huge consumer, he has 60-inch plasma screen. He has a sound system which takes 1,000 watts plus. And now he's talking about energy. You know why? Because now there have been studies in the UK where they say there will be power outages after 2015. That's the only thing that works, because he wouldn't think about these things. He thought I was a mad guy, living in Auroville, doing all these stupid things, living his normal life. So the aspirations in India are no different, because they also see BNO advertised in a local magazine. They also want BNO.
Right.
They also want. So the change behavior is not simple.
No, but it's possible here.
London is
a different situation.
Absolutely.
And you know, whereas Clinton, Bill Clinton says to, on the back of the book there, we should follow the advice of Lester Brown. But, that's unlikely. But in India, we can actually influence people in the government of India. And if we wanted to make that a little bit more of a priority, and we really put pressure on our friends in government, we might be able to actually make a difference with regard to policy.
You know, Rod, I'd like to say one thing to that. One thing which has shocked me in the past few months, the new Auroville Foundation office, the Government of India office, every time you go there in the evening, all the lights are on. they leave the lights, outside lights on throughout the night, so...
just to reply to that, Rod, we are working, trying to work with the government of India. Hemant, who is the founder of Aurore, has been trying to change policy, or at least not change, but affect policy, for 15 years now. I've just joined the gang, and we are now trying to work with MNRE, which is the Ministry for Renewable Energy, to see how we can at least do one component, which is solar thermal. And they have now joined hands with the UN, and they're trying to replicate programs that they've done in other emerging countries to promote solar water heating. And now they just asked us to do a small study. But what we are trying to do now is gather enough data to make a convincing presentation to affect change in policy rather than just, you know, another study that they want us to do. So we are trying, and if you want to join hands, anybody else interested, more the merrier. We are trying our best to see how we can affect government policy in India.
Could you just comment on the solar thermal, though?
Actually, B?
Just one question.
Okay, the last question.
No, what I've heard is that everybody's buying their solar thermal from China because that's the only one that really works and is reliable. Is that true?
We import from China, and the reason is very simple, that if you want solar technology to be adopted, it has to be of the highest quality. If it isn't, then you give bad name to solar technology, and then, you know, future adoptions become more difficult because it creates a perception that it doesn't work. So it has to work in the first place. And to create these products, it's not a very, very complicated product, but India is not very good at manufacturing, you see. And you need a whole ecosystem of support industry to make quality products. It is happening slowly. And in years to come, the idea is to have the same kind of quality in India. But for now, it's better to import, for the sake of solar technology, to import from China.
Okay, in terms of personal sustainability, I promised that we would end at 12 today. I think it's almost at that time. Some of you who want to stay behind, if the presenters are willing, can kind of stay back and continue the discussion. I wanted to take my privilege as a presenter and just reintroduce the concept from last week. This is Brundtland's report definition of sustainability, that you have try to balance the economic objectives, environment objectives, and social equity objectives. If you can do that, then the intersection of these three E's is what's considered to be sustainable. In over 40 years in Oroville, we've learned that ideals rarely match the reality. So this is actually very rare. So what happens is that you are sometimes sacrificing environmental objectives in order to meet economic objectives, or social equity objectives in order to meet environmental objectives. So this is one of the issues that we wrestle with. So once again, sustainability is a journey, and we hope to see you all back next week to continue our journey together. Thank you.
Thank you.